Yeah, first of all, I want to thank Yeshiva University for inviting us to partner up and share the day with you. It's one of the most exciting opportunities that Israelites had for many, many years. So we appreciate you coming and joining us. What I want to share with you is one of the most profound ideas that was ever taught to me. But it's a very difficult idea. It's not so difficult, but it's a little bit out of the box. And I think that's what makes it difficult. It's actually very simple, but sometimes things that are very new and very different and out of our general way of thinking can make it difficult, not because we can't understand it, but because we're a little bit resistant because it's so different. So that's just a little introduction. But let me just start off with a little story. Actually, something that happened to me many years ago in New York City. I'm from a small town called Toronto. Actually, when I grew up, it wasn't such a big city like it is today, but it's still nothing like New York City, I mean, in my opinion. And I was walking in Manhattan, here in Manhattan, and the street was quite full. And I started becoming very aware of how tall the buildings were and how many people there were, and the hustle and the bustle, and I started to feel very intimidated by it, and I started to become quite aware of my smallness, my sense of insignificance. I got to the corner of a street, and the light was red, so the people were waiting because it was quite a major street. So suddenly I was in this crowd, and there were more people, and more people, and more crowded in, and more crowded in. At that moment, I just lost it, right? And I suddenly felt like I am no more than a fiber in a big melting pot of flesh. And that I'm garnished. I'm a nothing. Then the light turned green, and the blob of Manhattan began to move. And I no longer felt like I was even moving. I felt I was simply being drawn along, carried along in this stream of melted flesh. Okay? I'm doing this well before lunch so it doesn't disturb your digestion. Okay? And I'm feeling like nothing. Really, you realize you're nothing. You think yourself, you're nothing. I remember I once read something from a astrophysicist by the name of Eddington. He points out that if we were to fill all of Grand Central Station with dust, then one speck of dust, okay, one speck of dust would be planet Earth relative to the cosmos. Now, if there are about approximately 6 billion people living on this speck of dust, we'll call it planet Schmutz, okay, on this speck of dust, and we're not going to count all the insects and all the ants, and we'll leave that out of the equation, just human beings alone. That would mean that each and every one of us is much less than 1/6 billionth of a speck of dust, right? In other words, songs like Dust in the Wind is very optimistic, right? We are not even dust in the wind. We are 1/6 billionth of a speck of dust in the wind, but I guess it didn't fit into the lyrics so well. So they say, we'll give it to you. But really, we're nothing. We're mamish nothing. Everything from without tells us we're nothing. And yet, mysteriously, something within us tells us we're something. On that day, as I'm being carried by this blob of Manhattan, I suddenly see on one of the poles this flyer that's written in almost an unreadable scrawl, handwritten flyer, and it says, come to the Coco Cafe and hear the greatest guitar player in the world. Now, can you imagine the contrast? Now, here I am feeling like nothing, and some guy has the chutzpah to put a meaningless piece of paper that is almost unreadable and no less claim that he is the greatest guitar player in the world, playing in some hole called the Coco Cafe, who probably nobody's ever heard of. And I thought to myself, what an amazing feat that the humankind, amidst all this, somehow still believes that we are something. And not only do we think we're something, but a lot of us think we're actually maybe even the center of the universe. So as Rav Pinner mentioned before at breakfast, what really is Godless Adam? And this is key in terms of teaching Torah, especially in our generation, reaching out for sure in this generation, because people are starving to understand what is the source of their genuine self-worth. That's really what it's about. It's all about self-worth. And it has to do a lot with people's childish and destructive image of God. When I was a child, I was intensely aware of how possible tragedy could be. My mother, Zichrona Livracha, was a survivor of the Holocaust, and it was not infrequent that I would wake up in the middle of the night from my mother screaming from a nightmare. Now, I didn't know what the nightmare was. Could have been me. I don't know what the nightmare was. But being that I knew that my mother was a survivor of the Holocaust, I immediately assumed that she must be having dreams about the concentration camp. I continue to think that I was correct on that fact. And I lie there in the middle of the night wondering, what kind of God allows such evil, such cruelty, such pain to happen in the world? And at a very young age, I was struggling with, who is there a God? And if there's a God, who is this God? And what on earth does God want from us? At a very young age, I was struggling with these questions. And I remember, you know, you're a little kid, you don't really know who to ask. I didn't think I could talk to my parents about this, and I certainly knew I was not going to ask my Hebrew school teacher that I used to go to Hebrew school every day for 2 hours. That was certainly not a place that I found inspirationally, philosophically interesting. And I remember one day, I was playing with my hamster. My parents bought me for my birthday a hamster. And I maybe was, I don't know, 8 or 9 years old. And I was a little sadistical kid, right? And I was putting my hamster through hell. I had him do all kinds of tricks and obstacles and see how he deals with falling off the table. I don't know what I did, but I did some pretty mean things to this little hamster. And then one day it hit me that just maybe this is why God has created us. That maybe, just as I was bored and my parents bought me a hamster for my entertainment, maybe God was bored. And just like I needed a hamster for entertainment, maybe God needed a pet. And I'm his humster, right? And he puts me through all these obstacles and all these problems, and that's his cheap thrills. I mean, not a very positive, inspirational, loving image of God. But I was trying to figure out, who is God? Why am I here? And what does God want from me? And I want you to know that this is probably the biggest problem facing religion in general today, but I'm most interested in Yiddishkeit, obviously. God has a very bad name in the world. Okay? And there's a book that came out, which I highly recommend you not read, which is called Foreskin Lament, which is written by a fellow who went to yeshiva. And he basically puts it, he's got a lot of chutzpah in this book. He writes in his book that if we were to put all of the Bible into Word, pull out the name God, put in the name Alan, would anybody be interested in Alan? Would anybody want to praise Alan? Would anybody admire Alan? Alan looks like a pretty angry kind of a guy. He kills people, he floods people. If you're on his side, he loves you. But if you don't quite do what he asks, he wipes you out. And then we're supposed to say, praise be he. Okay? In a very strong book, some very difficult questions. And this kind of genre of books are coming out now. You know, I think a lot of people got very excited. In fact, when my first book came out, Endless Light, 97, so the publisher of Simon & Schuster said to me, you know, years ago I would not have even looked at a book like this, a book about God, soul, it would never sell. Right? But what can I tell you? The market's changed and God is in. Okay? And he sells books. Okay, so, but I want you to know that God is becoming not so in lately. And now you've got this new genre of books about atheism, and there's a book that I've seen on shelves all over the place, on, you know, front row shelves, windows of Barnes & Nobles, called God, in the little, is bigger, not great, and the word great. And the subtitle of the book is How Religion Poisons Everything in Our Lives. And this book must be doing well, because if you go into a store and you see it up front, on the shelves, in the window, that means something's going on. People have a lot of stuff with God. And that's because God, in their mind, makes them feel like nothing. And I remember a fellow walked into one of our Israelite seminars, and he was wearing a t-shirt. It was a Calvin and Hobbes t-shirt. And on the t-shirt, basically, Hobbes, the toy tiger, turns to Calvin and says, Calvin, do you believe in God? And Calvin's got this philosophical look on his face with his hands behind his back looking at him. He says, well, somebody's out to get me. And that's how he knows there's a God, because somebody's out to get him. Okay? So I want you to understand, this is not just the non-frum kid. Okay? In fact, this guy who wrote this book grew up in a frum home, went to yeshivas that you are familiar with, even spent at least a year, maybe even two, in Eretz Yisrael in yeshiva. Right, and he writes a book which is basically, he actually has a little, he proudly wears a neck chain that has the name Acher on it. Could you imagine that? He proudly identifies himself with Acher. All right. Now, quite frankly, I think this fellow has simply taken his distorted understanding of God to its rational, logical conclusion. And I don't hold him responsible, quite frankly. I hold the educational system more responsible, that there is something wrong, and either we are not addressing the issue of who is God and who are we and what are we doing on this planet, and we're just assuming that people get it. You know who God is. It's right here, God. Now let's get to the halacha. How do you make tea on Shabbos? Now believe me, I love knowing how to make tea on Shabbos. But if I think the reason why I'm concerned about the halachic issues of how to make tea on Shabbos is because God is this angry God who has a pet called David Aaron, his humster, and gets his cheap thrills by making my life difficult, right? With that frame of reference, you will read Torah with those eyes. This guy who wrote that book, he has these eyes, and when he reads Torah, he sees this ugly God. He sees this angry God. He sees this vengeful, punitive God. And therefore, we as mechanchim, educators, inspirers, and even if we're not mechanchim, as parents, right? The most important issue that has to be addressed educationally is, who is God? And what does God want from me? You know, there's a program called 12 Steps that has taken the world by storm. It has addressed every kind of addiction that one could imagine. Right? So the first step is, I have a problem. I have to acknowledge I have a problem. The second step is, I cannot beat my problem on my own. The third step is, there's a higher power that will help me. But I'm told that that third step is generally the most problematic step for most people. If they can get past that step, they can really get to a place of healing. But the problem is that most of the people, especially since 12 Steps is non-denominational, they will not address or define for you who this higher power is. Okay? So that's up to you. Whatever higher power means to you. But most people, higher power means to them this God who's up there, who is almighty and omnipotent and all-knowing, and in his presence I feel all weak and all stupid and all garnished. And if that's what is the paradigm of a person, then all of Torah will play into their paradigm, their hard drive, which is the basics of who is a Kadosh Baruch Hu, that will color everything of their Yiddishkeit. And yet that very issue, I find, is least addressed, right, in the educational world today. And I'm talking not only as a teacher, I'm talking as a parent. With Baruch Hashem, we have 7 children. And I'm seeing in their own education, I think my kids went to pretty good schools, right? But in my kids' schools, there are a good few kids that are off the derech, and these are good schools. And not only that, these are good families. These are kids whose parents are rabbanim. My son is shocked. He tells me, you can't believe it. I can't believe how are these guys, Mechalel Shabbos, going to the beach on Yom Kippur, and they grew up in firm homes, and their parents are well-known rabbanim, right? So nobody, just to know, nobody, right, is absolved from this responsibility of what is the image, or more correctly, the non-image that you are going to give over to your kids, or to your talmidim, or to your congregants. Right, of who is the Ribbono Shel Olam, and everything flows from there. So that's a little introduction to what I want to share here. And you know, it's interesting in the world of Merkaz Rav, they generally do not learn until much later Orot HaKodesh. This is a piece from Orot HaKodesh. Rav Kook wrote many books. In fact, most of his books aren't even published yet. There's a vault of hundreds of manuscripts that have not yet been released, and it's even questionable whether they will be released, because I understand that some of the things that are written in these manuscripts are so controversial, right, that I understand that there are many pieces that still not have been allowed out into the public eye, okay, in terms of the depth of the thinking and the chadshanut, the innovation of thinking, which I don't quite think was necessarily innovative, because it was really revealing the ancient tradition of Yiddishkeit. But Orot HaKodesh is broken up into 3 parts. Orot HaKodesh volume 1 would be more specifically, philosophically referred to as epistemology, the nature of knowledge, the validity of knowledge, how we perceive the universe, and to what extent is our perception valid. Okay, and the impact perception has on our life experience. That would be more the general theme of Orot Kodesh Aleph. Orot Kodesh Bet is what would be called philosophically ontology, the nature and the study of being. Being. And then volume 3, and now there's even a volume 4, would really be Musar, which is once you understand the nature of consciousness and how it perceives being, then all of Musar flows from there. And that's something just in general you have to know, that your behavior is a direct outcome of how you perceive yourself and how you perceive people. It's as simple as that. If you want to change yourself, you have to change your perception. So I found personally real transformation in my life when these ideas were shared with me, right? And so we'll just jump right in. Now, again, these concepts deserve much more than one day or even 2 days. I personally have been teaching this material for, at this point, 20 years. I never get tired of teaching over these pieces of Rav Kook, because every single time it actually gives me an experience of who I am and what I'm part of, and it really is very inspirational stuff. But it's, as I mentioned, it's for some people very much out of the box, and I realized that it would be very helpful if we had some kind of a board. I'm sorry, I should have requested that. Or even a piece of paper or something, just because I think I'll have to line out something for you. So I apologize, I should have asked for that. Okay, so let's jump right in. All right.
Well, until somebody else has.
Well, it's good, because this is all about imperfection, and this is a good way to start. Okay. All right, good. Um, You know, let's just read it. I think there's something to be said for first confusing your Talmidim until they're utterly despaired, and then revealing to them the truth, and you look really good about that. So let's do that. Let's go right into it, right, without much more introduction. And I'm intentionally not making this too simple, because I think the question and the struggle with the question sets the stage for the power of what he's about to reveal. Now, Rav Kook does say about himself that he said no chidushim. What he says is all based on Kitvei Arizal, the teachings of the Arizal. And so, but a lot of people didn't quite see it. I remember I was pretty shocked when I was speaking to my Rebbe, Rav Shlomo Fischer. I asked Rav Shlomo, where do you find the Torah that's mamish light, that just sets your soul on fire? And he said to me, he said he believes it's in the writings of Rav Kook and Rav Tzadok. And that really shocked me, because my Rebbe never talked about Rav Kook, right? Not to me anyways. So I was really shocked at my first response, because I was coming from, I went in a number of Haredi yeshivas for a good few years, and in those yeshivas Rav Kook certainly was not, well, in any ways the way I understood it, was not a respected figure in Jewish history. So I was very surprised that Rav Shlomo Fischer, who was one of the lights of this yeshiva, actually says to me, Rav Kook. And my immediate response was, well, where's his sources? Which is what everybody's big question on Rav Kook is, where's his sources? So my Rebbe said, Kol HaTorah Kula. Right? That's where his source is. He says, Rav Kook doesn't give you a source here, a pasuk there, because it's not a pasuk here, it's not a pasuk there. It's when you are like a computer, and you have Kol HaTorah Kula, right, then you know this is pshat. Right? This is pshat. And if I were to give you a pasuk here and a midrash there, it would actually diminish the centrality of the idea. Now, if my Rebbe said that, and he knew Kol HaTorah Kula, I mean, if I would ask Rav Shlomo Fischer a question, you know, where does it say this or that, he would go like this. Well, it's not in the Chumash. It's not in Nach. Not in the Midrash. Not in the Gemara. Not in Yashami. Not in the Zohar. Oh. It isn't the Gemara. That's exactly what he'd do. He would scan in his mind. I was like, unbelievable, his abilities. So if he says Rav Kook's source is Kol HaTorah Kula, a man who seems to have a good handle on Kol HaTorah Kula, I'm okay. I'm ready. I buy in. Okay? So let's read this together. Megamat HaVaya Kula. The purpose of existence being in total, in general. Mitzad chifetz hakamutz ha'ein sofi, from the standpoint of the hidden, endless desire. He kefi hi glota lanu, it is, this magama, is, according to way it's revealed to us, eitza gdola, a great plan, shel hit alut v'hosafat nitzchit, a plan for an eternal increment, ascent. She'im ein mitziyut shel kotel, if there were not the existence of smallness, v'chisaron, or deficiency, lo yuchal liyot rak godel v'milui, then there could only be greatness and fullness, avolo hitgadlut, but there couldn't be growth. V'drichat tadirit l'tosefet bracha, and a guiding, a directive of constant increment and blessing. And even though there is no end to the greatness of complete perfection, there's nothing more to add to, because it's Ein Sof. How do you add to Ein Sof? Right? Nonetheless, kaluba, included within perfection, kaluba gam kenzeh koach hanisgav, included within this perfection is this lofty power, so hit alut hadirit, the possibility for constant growth, for constant ascent. V'zenechshav, and this would then be considered ki'ilo shleimut hamuchlata, as if the absolute perfection mishtalemet becomes perfected ayadei hishtalmut, through a becoming perfection. Habal yedei hofat hakotem, that happens through the manifestation of smallness, Habaya Lagodol, that comes to greatness, Vavoda Zu Tzorech Gevoa. And this work, what work? What work is of great necessity?
Growth.
Exactly. This dynamic life of constant ascent and growth, increment, bracha, this is an avoda, right? That is of great necessity. Okay, let's look at another piece, which kind of very similar, but adds a few more clues to this puzzle, and then we'll try and pull it together. Look at number three. Mivinim anu, we understand. I want to at this point out that Rav Kook is being very clear. In this first piece, we saw, he said, kefi higlota lanu. Right? What I'm talking about is the way it looks to us. The way it's revealed to us. And again, Rav Kook is very clear. Mivinim anu, we understand. Right? This is a basic premise in Kabbalah. Right? It's the disclaimer that without it, you walk into danger zone. The disclaimer is that the Kabbalah only talks about Or Ein Sof, but not really the Ein Sof himself. Okay? Why Or Ein Sof? Because Or suggests how it's revealed. Not what it is, but as it appears to us. So this is something you have to always remember. What we're about to describe really, from Hashem's perspective, is nonsensical. Okay? From Hashem's perspective, this is not correct. But from our perspective, this is the best we can do with the words that we have and the limited concepts that are available to us. We necessarily have to describe the Ein Sof, Hashem, in a paradoxical way. But is Hashem paradoxical? How many think Hashem is paradoxical? How many think Hashem is not paradoxical? How many people are chicken? Okay. Or soya for the vegetarians here. Okay. The truth is, Hashem is whatever Hashem is, and it's beyond our comprehension. However, we have a mitzvah to comprehend Hashem as much as we have the capacity to comprehend the Shem. And we have to just remind ourselves that this is from our perspective relative to our ability to think. The truth is, science is saying the exact same thing, right? Science will no longer say this is what an atom is, this is what a molecule is, right? Rather, they'll say this is how a molecule appears to us based on our experimentation. Right? For instance, one of the great mysteries in science is the identity of light. Light. Is light a particle or is light a wave? And at one point, they thought that light was a particle until somebody set up an experiment and then demonstrated that light was actually a wave. But it didn't seem to in any way interfere with when we did the other experiment to see if it was a particle. It indeed behaved like a particle. Depending on the kind of experimentation, so to speak, the viewpoint we took on the light, it would either appear as a wave or it would appear as a particle. But it can't be a wave and a particle because they are mutually exclusive. Right? So therefore, science had this deep, serious problem, right? Either light has to be either a particle or light has to be a wave, but it can't be both. And that's when quantum physics kicked in and said, no, why not? The problem of science is it looked at the world and assumed that the world functions according to the systems of our thinking. But what if it doesn't? Right? Right? They say a story, it's a true story, Nebuchadnezzar, it's a story on the beach of Tel Aviv, where a fellow is attacked by a terrorist, but this terrorist, I guess, had a little bit of, whatever, a little bit of, let's say, manners, and says to this person walking on the beach, "Are you an Israeli or are you an American?" Right? Before he killed him. And he said, "I'm a tourist." Right? Which is, there's a third possibility that you didn't ask me, which is maybe I'm neither American or an Israeli, but I only gave you two options. So one of the big challenges and one of the big chidushim of science is science just assumed that reality can be perceived by us. That our way of thinking matches the way life is. And the chidush of quantum physics was no. Life operates in a way that is not compatible with the limited systems of our thinking. And therefore, to comprehend life, it's a little bit like putting your CD into your cassette player, right? And you can't, right? But in this case, you can to a certain extent. So therefore, I want you to understand that all this is from our perspective. Okay? This is not from a Kodesh Baruch Hu's perspective. And the reason why this is important, because nonetheless it is our perspective and it helps us understand who we are and the role that we play in the universe. Okay? Alright. So now let's go on to this third piece over here. Mevinim anu b'shleimut Elohit. We understand regarding divine perfection, hamuchlata, absolute divine perfection, shnei arachim shel hashlema, two values, two types of perfection. Erech echad shel hashlema, one type of perfection, shemitzad godla v'gmirata, that from the standpoint of its greatness and its completeness, ein shayach b'hosafa shemayla, it has no possibility for growth. There's nothing it can grow from to. It's perfect. Avah im lo hayta shavrut shel hosafa hay, if there wasn't the possibility of growth to absolute perfection, right? Zebatzmo inyan chisaron. Then that would be a deficiency. You mean that absolute perfection cannot grow? Then you're saying that absolute perfection has a limitation to it. You can't say that too. Keshleimut ha'ochlechet v'nosefet, because perfection that advances and progresses tamid, constantly, yesh ba'yitaron, it has a certain advantage. V'tanug, and a certain ecstasy. V'ezamin ha'ala, and has a certain advantage. Sha'ano arginla, that we ourselves yearn for. Halicha mechayel echayel, we love to grow. We yearn to move from power to power. And therefore, this is something we love, Rav Kook is saying. How could the Ein Sof, how could absolute perfection, how could divine absolute perfection be missing this quality of growth? Asher alkein lo tuchal ashleimot elohit liyot chaser azu. Therefore, divine perfection could not be missing this kind of perfection. Chaser is a yitron shel hosaf hakoach, this ability to add. Valzeh, and therefore, yesh be'elohut kisharon shel yitira. Therefore, we describe divinity as having the potential for creativity, hitavut olamit, the becoming of worldliness, habilti mugbala, an endless becoming of worldliness. Ha'olechet b'chol archecha v'mitala, that continues and advances, thank you very much, and ascends. V'nimsa, and we therefore find sh'neshama Elohit, the divine soul itself, atzmit shebahavaya, that's in being. Ha'mechayelta, that brings and gives it life, hu ailu et midiaza, it's this power to grow. Shehu hu ayisod Elohi, this is the foundation of its godliness, HaKoreoto, that calls to it, Limatze, to become, Lishtachlel, to improve. V'kol ma she'amada holech u'mitbases, and to the extent that science establishes itself, al yisod ha'hitpatchut, on the foundation of evolution, hu holech u'mitkarev el'or Elohit, it comes closer to the true revelation of godliness. Hayoter bihila, the most clear. Ubal chazon hayoter elyon, it finally gets the higher vision. Rav Kook is saying that the theory of evolution is science finally getting it right. That's a shock to most people. Most religious Jews feel that they have some holy responsibility to fight evolution. Okay? And Rav Kook is saying, no, finally science is getting closer to what we've been teaching all along. That life is in fact an evolutionary process of growth and progress, and it'll never end. Okay. So now that you've probably had a bit of a shviras akelim over here, that these ideas are perhaps a little bit much, let's put this out and explain it. Let me ask you a question. What do you think? Can the perfect become more perfect? Right? That's basically the question Rav Kook is answering here. Can the perfect become more perfect? Well, generally people will say no. I mean, it seems to be the first and most obvious response. Because if the perfect became more perfect, that would mean that it was initially imperfect. Where would it move from to? How could the perfect become more perfect? That's a ridiculous. That's just totally ridiculous. Right? It's like the same question that you might sometimes get from annoying people who say, can God create a rock that he himself cannot pick up? Okay? And then you're stuck. Because he says, you're telling me God is almighty, right? I say, well, yeah. Okay. So if he's so almighty, can he create a rock that he cannot pick up? So if you say no, they say, oh, he's not almighty. If you say yes, they say, oh, he's not almighty. So you know what you say to them? You say, you and I should get together on Purim. Ad delo yada. Right? Because Purim, you'll understand this. But you got to have a couple of Jack Daniels. Right? Gematria, Yudke, Vavke, Elokim. Right? Right? Because that's really beyond the beyond. It's like they say, Rav Shlomo Kalbach used to say, what's the difference between a shikr during the year and a shikr on Purim? So during a year, if you show a drunk, you know, five fingers, he says, two. If you show him three fingers, he says, it's four. Right? You show him one finger, he says, it's five. That's all year long. That's what happens to a shikr. But on Purim, Rav Shlomo says, if you show a shikr five fingers, he's going to see one. If you show him three fingers, he's going to see one. If you show him four fingers, he's going to see one. Because all he sees is oneness. Right? That's on Purim. So the truth is, if someone says to you, can the Almighty create a rock that he himself cannot pick up? The answer is yes and no. And he says, well, you can't say that. He says, what do you mean? Why can't I say that? Why do you expect God to fit into the neat packaging of your logical system? This is what the Greeks did to our thinking. The Greeks came up with what they considered to be logic. They therefore assume that the universe operates according to these very narrow, right, expectations of what they call logic. And until quantum logic came to mankind, people thought that there's an either or. But quantum logic proves that the world, existence, is beyond the either or. And therefore the answer is, can God create a rock that he himself cannot pick up? It's beyond the or, either or. The answer is yes and or no. Simultaneously. So too over here. Can the perfect become more perfect? And the answer is yes and no. If you say that the perfect cannot become more perfect, then that would mean that the perfect is limited. If you say that the perfect can become more perfect, then that would imply that the perfect wasn't perfect, was imperfect. And so the answer is that your mind will just have to accept the paradox of perfection. And this is the paradox of perfection. The paradox is you have absolute perfection. And absolute perfection is just beyond dot. It's beyond logic. Okay? But when we describe absolute perfection, right, with our limited conceptual philosophical vocabulary, then we describe absolute perfection as having two values of perfection. Now, I ask you, does absolute perfection have two values of perfection?
Nope.
Absolutely not. This whole shtick of two has nothing to do from Kaddish Baruch Hu's point of view. It's just we're trying to understand the absolute perfection with the limited kalim that we have. You follow that? Okay, just as when they said in science that light is both a particle and a wave, do you think light is schizophrenic? Do you think light is like, gee, I wonder, am I a particle, but maybe I'm a wave, but you know, like maybe I'm a particle, you know, like, no. Light is whatever it is. But when we describe light, we describe it in a paradoxical way. Okay? So too, when we try to describe the Orein Sof, the unlimitedness of godliness, we describe it as if there are two faces to the one perfection. And those two faces are Shleimut, okay, and Rav Kook calls it Hishtalmut. Okay? In English, referred to as being perfect and becoming perfect. Okay? Being perfect and becoming perfect. From the standpoint of the being perfect, then it is static. Okay? From the standpoint of the becoming perfect, it is forever dynamic. Okay? And these are the two faces, from our perspective, of the one simple, absolute perfection of the Ein Sof. Okay? All right. So Rav Kook says, very simply, if absolute perfection was missing the possibility of becoming, then that would be a deficiency. Right? Absolute perfection cannot be deficient of deficiency. Right? It can't be chaser chisaron. Because if it was chaser chisaron, then there'd be no possibility for growth. And growth is a wonderful thing. Right? If good can't be better, right, then how good can it be? So Rav Kook is telling us over here that there are two values of perfection, being perfect and becoming perfect. Now, where did he get all this from before I fill in the blanks? He got this clearly, and this is the most amazing pshat of the Arizal. The Arizal teaches, oh, we would have been, oh, wait a second. No. Okay, well, we're going to erase this. I hope you engrave this eternally into your brains, okay? All right. Rav Kook basically is giving us pshat on the tzimtzum of the Arizal. The Arizal says, in the beginning, all of existence was endless light, or Ein Sof Pashut. The Arizal is very clear in saying Pashut, simple, because what I'm about to say is complex beyond belief. And I want you to remember that it's simple. It's just your complex. It's simple. Right? It's your brain that is making a whole narshkeit out of this. But this is simple. Okay? There is one light. But when we describe this one light, it gets very complicated. Because Hashem created Adam Yishar. Avuhu bikesh cheshbonot rabot. You want it to be complex? Okay, fine. Okay, you want it to be complex? Here you go. Okay? So in the beginning, all of this was endless light. But then the Arizal describes something called tzimtzum. Right? Which is that the Ein Sof, from the center of Ein Sofiyuto, which of course makes no sense, where's the center of Ein Sof, of endlessness? It's everywhere and nowhere. Right? But again, this is not to be taken literally. From the center Ein Sof, the Ein Sof caused a withdrawal of his light. Right? You should be impressed with my circle. I've been drawing this circle for about 25 years now, so I'm very impressed with this circle. Right? And out of this, Hashem creates a vacuum. And what do you think this vacuum represents? What does it represent based on what we've just so far shared? What?
Absence of perfection.
Exactly. This is chisaron. Right? Here is this area, so to speak, which creates the setting for lack of perfection. And where does lack of perfection exist? Within perfection. If perfection is missing, lacking, missing deficiency, then that would be a deficiency. Okay? All right. Remember, think about this on Purim. Okay? This is all Hachana the Purim. All right? So, it then says that within this void called Chalal Panui, okay, Hashem creates, and I'm editing a lot, so forgive me over here. Hashem creates vessels. But these vessels are finite, right? Of course, the light is endless. It then says that Hashem, the Ein Sof, activates another kind of tzimtzum, which would be more correctly referred to as a condensation or a concentration of Or Ein Sof, and condenses this light into a thin ray, gives over the thin ray to the finite vessels, but because they're finite, they cannot handle the light. So they break. He goes to the next vessel and it breaks. Now, I want to get into technicalities because the first three vessels actually did not break, but we're not going to do that right now. Okay? The last seven vessels break. There are 10 vessels and the seven last ones break, which is 7 Yimei Breishit. Okay. And everything breaks. And everything goes into a state of tohu. Chaos. Now again, where is all this breakdown happening? Where is all this tohu, chaos, found? Where is it all found? Where? Within?
The world.
Right, but where is it all found? It's all found within the context of absolute perfection. Again, the point is that within absolute perfection exists the possibility for imperfection, breakdown, and then the rest of life is called tikkun olam. And that's why you and I are here. And that's what every single day of your life is about. Tikkunim. You and I are all born with a gift mishamayim. That gift is imperfection. Right? You come in this world with something imperfect, something chaotic. And your life is to become, to improve, to be metaken. Okay? But then the Arizal says something that then blows us out of the water after he gives this incredibly, fascinating, dynamic description of Yerida Letzorech Aliyah. That's what this is. Yerida Letzorech Aliyah. Then the Arizal says that, by the way, although the light surrounds the vacuum, it actually continues to fill the vacuum. So what did he just say? Why does he now say that although the light surrounds the vacuum, it actually continues to fill the vacuum, as if nothing happened, something happened, yet nothing seemed to happen? What did he just say? Right? In the language of Rav Kook, what is that referring to? You've got, again, two types of perfection. Actually, three. There's absolute perfection, and when we describe absolute perfection, there is becoming perfection, and then there is being perfection. There's dynamic perfection that is ever-growing, and there is static perfection that is never-changing. Ah. So when the Arizal comes back and tells us that the light never moved, what does that refer to? These are your three choices. Absolute perfection, becoming perfection, or being perfection. Which one is he referring to now? Being perfection. Okay? So let's start the story again. In the beginning, all of existence was absolute perfection. When the divine wanted to express the possibility of a being perfection, a becoming perfection, I'm sorry, a becoming perfection that moves from imperfect to more perfect, imperfect to more perfect, then kibyechol, the Ein Sof can create and accommodate a place within absolute perfection for this evolving perfection, while simultaneously remaining perfect, and the light still fills the vacuum. Okay, so now let's read Rav Kook, and now I think it's going to all lay out really quite nicely. Okay? We're going to look at three. Mevinim anu b'shleimut Elohit, we understand, this is all from our perspective, this is as best as we can do with the words that we have. Mevinim anu b'shleimut Elohit ha-muchletet shnei archim shel hashlama. Okay, so there's shleimut Elohit ha-muchleta, absolute, and then there are shnei archim shel hashlama. Erech echad shel hashlama, shemitzad gadla gmirata, that from the standpoint of its greatness and completeness, ein shayach ba hosafa shemala. There's no such thing as growth, right? Aval im lo hayta efsharut shel hosafa. But if there was not the possibility of growth, evolving ascent, zebatzmo inyan chisaron, then that itself would be a matter of deficiency. Absolute perfection would be deficient in what? In deficiency. And deficiency is part of a kind of perfection, is dynamic perfection. Okay? The truth is, becoming perfect, evolving perfection, has a certain advantage. It has an oneg, a pleasure. It's got an advantage, right? And a loftiness to it, a supremacy to it. We are yearning for halicha mechayo achayo, that we should grow from power to power. Asher al kain, therefore lo tuchal ashleimut elohit liyot chasera zuha yitaron shil chosafat hakoach haver. Therefore, divine perfection could not be missing this possibility, okay, of becoming perfection. All right. And therefore, he goes on to say that therefore the soul of the universe is the godliness that drives us to grow, drives us to be mitaken. Okay, so now, with a couple of minutes I have left for this session, and we will continue later on. So now you understand why you exist. Because the big question is, why did a perfect God create an imperfect world? Why did a perfect God create an imperfect me? And why is life so difficult? Right? Now, most people, sadly enough, think their paradigm of the human-divine relationship is that there's a being floating in outer space over there. The first Russian astronaut, when he went into outer space, they asked him, "What do you see?" And he said, "I don't see God." Right? What did he think he'd see? Right? He thought he would be driving along, and suddenly he'd see these two big eyes peering at him, saying, I am God. What took you so long?" Right? What did he think? But I want you to know that this is why a lot of people don't believe in God. And you know what? They should not believe in God. If that's the God they think they're supposed to believe in, they're Avodah Zaraniks. That's mamash Avodah Zara to think that Hashem is some being floating in outer space. That's mamash and Avodah Zara. Right? Rav Kook calls it conceptual Avodah Zara. So they're actually on a very high madrega. That's why Rav Kook says that there's certain people whose emunah is kafira, and there's certain people whose kafira is emunah. Okay? It's a scary thing. It's a very scary thing. You might be davening in a minyan of Ovdei Avodah Zarah. Right? It's a scary thing. They've got this crystallized, childish image of God floating in outer space. And people think that this God, for some ludicrous reason, who has really no vested interest in us, decided to snap his fingers, you know, Almighty Evan, and go boom, right, and create us. Right? And he created us. And we're Nebuchs. Right? And we feel constantly we're losers. Then we read Torah how we're supposed to become perfect tzaddikim. And we all know we ain't going to make it. Right? And we feel really, really guilty about that. And we try and we try and we try, but we fail and we fail and we fail. But we sometimes get it right, we sometimes get it wrong, and we start to get into Yeush. Because we feel we are never going to be perfect. Right? We are simply never going to be perfect. And we start to resent the Kodesh Baruch Hu. I remember growing up feeling a resentment, like Yom Kippur, Rosh Hashanah. I resent you judging me. Right? You come into this world. Go ahead, let's see how you deal with this schmutz place. Right? You walk down the street. Right? You see all these billboards and this disgusting music. And you go into this world. It is so simple. You know, there's a very scary story of Elie Wiesel. It's a story about a little boy that's being hung by the Nazis. Right? And I can't remember who the character here, but maybe the father. He challenges God. He says, "Okay, let's make a switch. You become man, and we'll become God." So God says, "Okay, we'll do it for a day." Right? And so that's what happens. God takes the place of man. Man takes the place of God. At the end of 24 hours, God says, "Okay, enough. Let's change back." And man says, "No. I'm not coming back. You stay man, I'm going to stay God." This is the kind of stuff people are deeply feeling. Whether they're able to articulate this is not the problem. The problem is, in a deep subconscious way, people believe, and they're right, that the Torah they're being taught is Avodah Zarah. And especially if they're Jewish neshamas have such a slida, they have a resistance to Avodah Zarah. And if they think God is some being floating out of space over there, and he zaps his finger, and he creates us in an imperfect world, and we're imperfect, and we never get it right, but he constantly judges us and has high expectations of people that he intentionally created as low creatures with a Yetzirah. You have a Yetzirah, right? And then go look at the Midrashim, how the Yetzirah, not only do you have a Yetzirah, but every day you have a better Yetzirah, meaning better at what it does, right? Every day the Yetzirah finds new strategies and new techniques to up, you know. So at a point you just feel like, "I'm never going to win this game. I will never be perfect." And now you understand, and this is so deep. Right? This is the deepest, right? why did Hashem create an imperfect world and put in that imperfect world an imperfect character, and then put in that imperfect character a chelek eloka mim'al, right? An aspect of himself called the neshama. Because you know what's so perfect about you? What's so perfect about you is that you're imperfect and that you become a little more perfect. And that's all you're expected to do, right? What's so perfect about this world? It's the perfect setting for becoming perfect. What's so perfect about you, right? You and your imperfection are a manifestation of this face of Ein Sofiut, this aspect of absolute perfection. And mi ashira samech b'chelko. And who is really rich? One who is happy with their portion. This is your portion. You are not going to be perfect, and you're not meant to be perfect, and no one expects you to be perfect. All you got to do today is grow a little bit more, because avodah zu tzarach gavoahi. This work, what work? What is this work that is of great, lofty importance to Kodesh Baruch Hu? What is this work? The work is tikkun, fix. And then it'll break, fix. Okay, it breaks, but you get it. And you keep fixing and growing and growing. And your life won't be all the way like this. It'll be like this, like this, like this. But you know what? Ultimately, we are going up. And we are part of an aliyah. But the Yerida, the Shviras HaKelim, was intentional. Hashem intentionally caused the breakdown to set the stage for an eternal process of building. And that's who we are. That is our chelik in the expression of the fullness of absolute perfection. Okay? And therefore, nobody's perfect. And we don't say that with a sense of nebuch, bidyavid. Halavai, we could be perfect. What can I say? Nobody's perfect. That's not true. Nobody's perfect is what's so perfect about you. In terms of the kind of perfect you are, there are two types of perfection. There's dynamic perfection and there's static perfection. Dynamic perfection includes within it what? Imperfection. And that's what's so perfect about that imperfection. Right? Static perfection does not include imperfection. But absolute perfection, when described by us, has two faces. One phase is the becoming perfect, which is actually described in Kabbalistic terms as zachar, more a male thing. And the other side of perfection is dynamic perfection, which is described more as female, which is the role of what's called the Shekhinah. The Shekhinah is the godliness that's at the core driving the becoming. And that's what we're here to do. Lo alecha mlacha ligmor. It's not for you to finish the work. But you cannot say, well, then I don't want to do it. Now that's a tragic thought for most people. What do you mean? I have to do this work and I will never live to see it completed? Right? Well, if you've got the wrong perspective, then that will really, really put you off. Right? Imagine the guy's building this building. And he gets in, his goal is to get to, who knows, 4,221. And he gets to the 4,014. And then suddenly he hears this voice from Shemayim, Lo alechem locha ligmor. What would he do? Wait, wait, I'm not going to finish this building? I'm not going to see this building to its finish line? I don't want to do it. Then you forgot what life is about. Life is about this moment. If in this moment you're growing, if in this moment you're struggling to make yourself in this world a little bit better, avodah zu gevoahi, tzarach gevoahi. This is your avodah Hashem. That's all Hashem wants from you. And bechlal, what does avodah Hashem mean? What can I do for God? Right? The whole concept of avodah Hashem makes no sense. Hashem wants you to do something for Him. What could you be doing for God? What are you, so to speak, doing for God? What are you, so to speak, providing for God? Right? What are you providing? What could you do for God? Right? So from our perspective, we think God is the being perfect, the perfect being. Right? But the perfect being isn't a full expression of the true meaning of God. So you in your becoming, you in your avoda, the more you serve by being mitakin your midos, the more you serve to be a mitakin in this world, this is your avoda Hashem. This is, so to speak, what you're doing for God. You are playing out. You are part of, you are the kli for the expression of this aspect of perfection. Right? And the goal of Jewish life is to become here now. In Eastern tradition, there was a concept called be here now. That is not a Jewish idea. Right? Right? We're too neurotic to just be here all now. We can't be so relaxed. Right? That's why it's a little hard to sell Yiddishkeit. Because the whole world is teaching you that you can find inner peace. And Yiddishkeit is saying, no, it's not about inner peace. You are intentionally created as a restless creature, restless to move, to grow, to fix, to improve. So true inner peace means learning to make peace with your battle. Right? And what is your battle? Your battle is to move forward and do it a little better. And make it a little sweeter. And fix it a little more. And it's about the being. And one last point. Imagine a guy is climbing up a mountain. And it's a long trek. He's sweating. He's in pain. His muscles are aching. He's gone on for days. And then some fellow comes by in a helicopter and says, what are you doing? What's your goal? He says, the top of the mountain. Right? He's got this flag. Top of the mountain. So the guy says, well, if that's your goal, look at you, how long have you been climbing? It's been about 3 weeks already. Well, jump in. Come into my helicopter. I could get you up there in 5 minutes. The guy would have this, what? If your goal is the top of the mountain, look at you, Nebuch. I could get you up there in 5 minutes. So he made a mistake. The goal is not the top of the mountain. The goal was every step of the climb. The top of the mountain was the means. The goal was every day, every moment, every step. That was the goal. And that's why so many people are unhappy. They think the goal is Yemelta Mashiach. They think the goal is Olam Haba. Right? That's really the top of the mountain. Real Olam Haba? Real Mashiach consciousness? Is when you're in the moment of your Avodas Hashem. In this moment, if you're able to take another step forward, to embrace your imperfection as part of your process towards greater perfection and greater perfection, then this is your Avoda, right? This is your Avoda. To celebrate every day as a possibility for greater growth. So there's absolute perfection, and when we describe absolute perfection, there are two types of perfection. Being perfect, which we generally perceive as God, and becoming perfect, which is actually us and this dynamic evolving world, right? But the truth of Ein Sof, the true meaning of absolute perfection is beyond a being perfect, or a perfect being, or a becoming being. It's absolute Ein Sof. So let's take a minute if you have a couple questions. Do we have a little time for a couple questions? Quick little questions. Yeah, you see, my watch says it's 6 o'clock right now, right? So I'm fine. So I'm fine in terms of my schedule, right? I did not change my clock because I want to be in Eretz Yisrael time, right? Two questions. Yes. You got a question?
At the end of the day, aren't we still Hashem's humster?
Absolutely not. Why are you Hashem's humster? Good question.
To fulfill his imperfection.
But you're creating a dichotomy now that there's his perfection and I'm like outside. You're no longer an outsider in this story. You are part of the unfolding of the full meaning of divinity. Right? It's not like this God and like he needs somebody to fill this role for him. That's no longer the point here, right? It's not like, well, I got somebody, I'm going to use you, right? Because I can't do this. So you're going to do this and I'm going to turn you into it. No! Hashem feels your pain. Anochi mo betzara. I'm with you with your pain. And when a person is sick, the Shekhinah is saying, my head hurts, my limbs hurt, right? Hashem has a completely vested interest in you, which is, so to speak, a piece of himself, which is in the Shema. You're a masterpiece. You're a piece of the master. Right? So it's not as if Hashem's over there, and now you're over here, and you're doing this thing, and Hashem's saying, well, I couldn't have done that, but I'm glad you're doing it, like some parent who couldn't live his life, so he wants, I couldn't become a doctor, so now my kid will become a doctor, and I'll live, you know, vicarious through him. That's not what it's about. It's about understanding the godless of who you are as an aspect of godliness. This is what's divine about your humanness. Right? Now, if you start thinking that you're divine, then you've missed the point. You have to find the divinity in your humanness, right? And realize that your becoming is no less an expression of absolute perfection than what you have so far been taught or thought is what God is all about, which, oh, he's the perfect being, and I'm just the loser here that's constantly trying to get my act together. Right? You getting your act together is no less an expression of the Ein Sof is what so far we've been thinking is the perfect being, right? But again, the danger of this idea is it's just an idea. From the standpoint of Ein Sof, there are no two values, right? None of all this is very misleading. But this is the best we can do with the words that we have. And the point is, and I tell you, I've taught this to people who have no background. You guys have been learning for years. But there's no such thing as people who have no background. People today have read a lot of very deep books. Especially Jews have read a lot of Hinduism and Buddhism. In fact, Deepak Chopra is a very famous best-selling Hindu doctor. He calls himself Hinju. Because he has so many followers that are Jewish, he says, I'm a Hindu. Okay? So I want you to know that the reason why one third of the entire Buddhist movement in America are Jewish, right? And the leaders are Jewish, is because the Jewish neshama has a lot of familiarity from very deep ideas, and if Torah does not share the deep ideas that people are ready for and are demanding and have already tasted in other traditions, right? Then they're going to say, the Yiddishkeit has nothing to offer me. Right? So these are very, very deep ideas. All right, we'll take one more question. Yeah.
How should we
get into Yamata Mashiach?
Sounds like that would be the point where we outlived our current.
Okay, so actually I'd like someone to answer that question. So, what about Yamata Mashiach? Will we have outlived our purpose? What will happen in Yamata Mashiach? Will the becoming end? What do you think? What? Why not? Because you continue to grow, right? This journey never ends. There's a certain stage of the journey where the growth is the battle against evil. But then we get to a place where we get past the battle against evil, and now it's about quality improvement, right? It's not like what before was bad, but what was for, right, I can even do it better, and even better. Listen, isn't that what life is all about? It's new and improved. By the way, that's the lie. How can it be new and improved? If it's new, then it's not improved, because it didn't exist before. If it's improved, then it means that it did exist. So they tell you it's new and improved. Right? It's a stira. It's beyond the either or. Right? But that's the point. Yemut HaMashiach, it was going to be, and Rav Kook addresses this, but he doesn't use the word Yemut HaMashiach. Yemut HaMashiach will still be in this dynamic form. We will constantly be growing, because we love to grow. And I'll tell you one last point. You know, when I was in yeshiva, nobody ever explained this to me, so I just assumed that Olam Haba, or when you die, you go to some realm where everything stops. No more anticipation. No more surprises. It's all what it was. And I had this image of kind of a Moshev Skanim, this old folks home, where now the good old days where life was adventurous and exciting is over. I got pictures of there I am climbing Mount Everest, there I am, but truly now there's no growth, there's nothing to struggle with, right? There's no surprises, and so I felt terrible that I didn't want to go there. But my rabbis kept saying, if you do mitzvahs, you get on Gan Eden. I'm thinking, man, Gan Eden is so boring. I like Olam Hazeh, right? Until, thank God, this was introduced, this is taught to me, and I realized, what are you talking about? Gan Eden, right, is going to be dynamic. But in Gan Eden, you'll be learning Torah, you're going to get a new pshat, and then an even deeper pshat, right? But you're not fighting against evil anymore, right? You're just now in the process of evolving from a good pshat to an even better pshat, to an even deeper pshat, to an even greater revelation. And this journey never ends. But this class just did. Okay.
Okay, we'll take a 2 minute break, and our biggest treatment will start at 11:00.
Thank you.
Thank you.